from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, October the 2nd, 2019. We've got a good show lined up for you today. One of our favorite regulars, Steve Pappas, is going to be joining me this morning to go over some of the happenings in the Central Vermont region where he edits the local paper, the Times Argus. Of course, he edits the Rutland Herald, too. That juggling act I've never quite understood, but maybe he'll share the secrets with us sometime. In the latter part of this hour, Mike Pichak's going to be stopping by. He's the Commissioner of Financial Regulation in the great state of Vermont, and he's going to be MC at a very important conference next week on financial planning, wide open to the public, and folks are being encouraged to turn out. This is going to be up in the Burlington area. We're going to find out all the whens and wheres for Mike, and so stay tuned for that. He's also, I think, going to maybe give some previews of coming attractions with a few tips on financial planning in our conversation this morning. So that should be quite interesting. Also, in the second hour of the program, Jarvis Green is going to be joining me on the phone from the White River Junction area. He is a director of a new theater production down there called Essay's Table. I'm going to try to double check the pronunciation there with Jarvis Green when we get him on the line, but I think that's what it is. It is an off-Broadway production, which actually is a very rare, maybe first-time ever thing in Vermont. I never say first-time ever, though, because then somebody calls up and says, well, you know, back in 1957. So it's a very rare thing is what I understand about going on in Vermont. And also, it's an all African-American production. And of course, it's an interesting effort to pull something like that off in a very, very predominantly white region of the country, like the Upper Valley of Vermont and New Hampshire. And so we're going to be talking with Mr. Green about all that. I think that'll be a very fascinating conversation as well. But let's get started this morning with our good friend Steve Pappas. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for joining me this morning. Some interesting stories in the Times Argus. What would you like to start with?
Well, I mean, I guess the thing that is being talked about on the street this morning the most is our top story, which is about how Barry pushed very hard for several years in a row for a local option tax that would be a small tax added to dining and some hotel visits in the area, and that the city had kind of banked on, at a minimum, kind of every time they brought this up, that it was going to rake in several $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And it's only been in place now for about a year. It failed two times before it actually was passed, and it got a lot of resistance in the community, not just from restaurants and hotels, but also from people who live in the community, who felt like it was not a good idea to, they didn't want to pay more for what they felt was something that is essentially, a service to them as it is. And they may have been proven right, because their revenue numbers came in way short by the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. And the city's kind of scrambling to figure out how that happened and how their conservative estimates came up so short. Now, some people could point to that and say, well, there's been, you know, maybe we're in an economic downturn of some kind, but Barry actually has been adding restaurants, and that storefronts are kind of filling up around us here in the Granite City. And so I don't think you can point to it and say that it's an economic downturn, but perhaps the model they're using to kind of make those budget predictions were just askew, and it's at the moment it's a little inexplicable, and that's kind of what the city is trying to get at, is how do we, they've come up with various kind of thoughts on the matter, but when you're depending on, and you fought this hard for a local option tax, and there's several communities around Vermont that have them where they've been very, very successful. I think there's 16 communities across Vermont or so, mm-hmm, that have local option taxes, and They are. They have been designated. It's designated money for certain things, and in Barrie, it was going to go toward street work, and that was one of the selling points was that, you know, you're always complaining about the streets, folks. You know, here's a way that we can actually pay for it with people coming in from out of town. Give them a little bit of a tax. And yeah, that didn't pay off, or it hasn't paid off in year one.
You know, the upside of the local option tax always is the revenue and some promise of city improvements or putting it toward the schools or whatever people want to do with the money. That's sort of the upside. The downside is that, and you hear this a lot from merchants or from restaurateurs and others who will be affected by the tax, barkeepers and so on, you know, saloon keepers, et cetera. The downside is that it'll drive business away. It'll cause folks to just go elsewhere and not come to. Is there any evidence that has been gleaned to date that downside is in play here?
No, I mean, I think that's the question at this point. Is, you know, what is driving that? I don't think it's because people stopped coming to Barrie because it had a local option tax.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't know, you know, does that mean people aren't ordering out as, you know, ordering as big a meal when they go out? I don't know. Is it fewer people are going out? Certainly the Barrie Opera House and the Barrie Auditorium, which have regular events here in Barrie, they're selling out in most cases. So it's not that people are afraid to come to Barrie and spend money. They seem to be doing it, probably not to the degree that a lot of folks wish they wish that they were doing more, that folks were buying more things here. But this is a little bit of a head scratcher.
Yeah, that is. It is. I remember when Montpelier was first debating its local option tax several years ago, there was a letter in a certain local paper, I think it's called the Times Argus, from a woman who lived in Worcester, and she was really, really annoyed about this local option tax idea in Montpelier. And she was saying she was going to do all of her business in Barrie, because, of course, Barrie didn't then have a local option tax. This is a sales tax. And so, and I remember thinking that, you know, so she lives in Worcester. She's going to drive twice as far to get to Barrie, and she's going to, you know, put a whole lot of more wear and tear in her car. She said she was going to avoid Montpelier, actually, I guess, drive the dirt roads across East Montpelier to Route 14 or something. And it was just, I mean, it was a completely silly exercise because, as I pointed out in talking with friends about it, on a $30 gallon of paint, she would have saved 30 cents for all of this extra time and effort to avoid coming into Montpelier. So, you know, I do think, I mean, people oftentimes, when they look at this at the beginning, they not only overestimate perhaps the city was overestimating its revenues collections here, but there's also a lot of overestimation of the impact on my daily life of the extra 30 cents on a gallon of paint. So that's...
But we're talking a big number here, Dave. We're talking about so far what they've seen in these first three solid quarters of having a local option tax. It's off by more than 30% each quarter.
That's
a big number. And I, you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, that they were looking at an annual income of about $200,000. I think it was $215,000 a year they were expecting in revenue.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be a conservative. That was based on, you know, years of consistent visitation to Barrie restaurants and hotels and such.
Yeah.
Not that Barrie has hotels per se, but there are a few places where you can stay in town. It's mostly driven by the restaurants. And like I said, there are more restaurants in town. So this is, you know, they've got some tough kind of conversations ahead because they're about to go into budget season, and you know, the city council and the city manager, I think, are going to have to really evaluate you know, what happens next, because not only did they come up short, but that also means that they came up short in the money that they were going to do for paving for 2021. You know, that's you know, you can't, in this day and age, you got to make those ends meet, because the taxpayers in Barrie City, especially, who are among the highest taxed in the county, are going to start grumbling and not pass your budgets again.
Well, let's shift gears here a bit, Steve. Things are looking a little more rosy financially for a certain presidential candidate from this part of the woods, and Bernie Sanders. Tell us about that.
He raised $25 million in the third quarter,
yeah,
which is a staggering, honestly, a staggering number, and basically puts Bernie in the same plane of the kind of elite candidates, Democratic candidates for president right mm-hmm. now. And there was a lot of question. There's been a lot of question. I think it's been discussed on your show in part when I was on and in the week since that, you know, Bernie might not be a viable candidate for right now. But certainly people who are putting their money on a candidate are, there's enough of them putting it on Bernie Sanders. Now, the flip side of that is that President Trump in the third quarter raised $123 million. So what the Democrats are raising and what Bernie is raising is kind of definitely a pittance compared to where the Republicans are putting their money. And I don't know the mechanization of how that's all happening, but that's $123 million is a big number, too.
Yeah.
A really big number. But,
well, one thing you got to remember is that really, you know, I mean, I guess Bill Weld is out there and this guy Joe Walsh from Ohio, but Trump is essentially flying solo on the Republican side, and he looks like, you know, he's clearly a safe, other than the impeachment issue, he's a safe bet to be the nominee for reelection in the Republican Party. And so whereas Sanders has to pretty much share the love with a bunch of other candidates, some of whom also have reasonable shots here. I mean, you think of Biden, Warren, certainly, maybe even Buttigieg or a couple of others who are, you know, sort of still in the game on the fundraising. So I haven't added up the numbers for the, say, six leading Democratic candidates in their fundraising, but that might get them back into the ballpark where Trump is, except that, of course, they're all dividing it up. So it looks like much smaller numbers.
Well, $25.3 million for Sanders, and then, as you mentioned, Buttigieg is kind of that's one of those ones that I don't think anyone thought that he was going to be in the top running for fundraising after the first quarter, but he's been consistent all three quarters so far. He has been one of the top four.
Yeah,
and this time around it was $19 million, and so you know, these are interesting times that you know, if you look at it as kind of like a horse race, people are definitely placing some pretty high bets.
Think there's a layered contest going on here, though? And by that I mean there's the polls and there the media mentions. That's one layer of the contest. I mean, actually, that's two layers of the contest. It's sort of how the media, how the national political media are treating you this week. That's one.
Mm-hmm.
And then another layer is what the polls are saying, which obviously clearly linked to how the national media are treating you. But then fundraising to me is really, to some degree, and again, not completely, they all have definitely play off each other, all these factors, but fundraising is a separate entity where sometimes what we're looking at here are specific campaigns that happen to just have crackerjack fundraising teams.
Yeah. Well, that's for sure. And what I was about to say when I interrupted you was that what we don't know is exactly kind of what the average contribution is. Bernie is renowned for having small contributions from a widespread number of folks.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the average contribution as we get closer is going up, and you know it's just hard to say. I'm sure that we'll hear from the Sanders campaign at some point pretty quickly about, you know, what the trends within the fundraising are, especially since they're doing so well, and you know, he got plenty of press today because of the fundraising.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see, but. It is interesting, and it definitely looks like we've got we've got a legitimate, not that we didn't have one before, but we've got a real race going on here.
You know, I guess the other thing here is you have to ask yourself, I mean, from a couple of different sides of this question, kind of the question of overall how is Sanders doing, and you know, the reporting lately has been, oh, Elizabeth Warren, the fellow progressive, is eating into his support. And V.T. Digger that just this week had a story talking about how some of the donors to Sanders in 2016 have actually switched to Warren. Now, it's a small number of people, but they tend to, you know, they were, I think, close to 200 people who had given more than $1,000 to Sanders in the 2016 contest were now supporting Warren. And so you don't really know that's a kind of one level of magnification in the glass, right? You know, or the magnifying glass. And then when Sanders comes back and says, I've got a whole bunch of donors who are giving small money. Does that ever show up in poll numbers? I mean, the implication seems to be that's what you want to say is my support is really, really broad. But does that ever actually, do you actually see a blip in poll numbers that would indicate that?
I think they do. I'm not sure that trickles down to our level of the media. But I don't think they would do it if they weren't getting a return, you know, a pretty good yield on the return.
Yeah, yeah. And just the press coverage, you know, where, I mean, Sanders was kind of the flavor of the week in 2016, and a lot of folks fault him for just repeating his same old messages over and over again. I think there's some strength and some maybe some weakness to that. But is that some of what's going on here? Is the media just see Elizabeth Warren as kind of the hot new thing?
It may be that the media is tired of Bernie's message and his delivery, and you know he does consider. He is quite bombastic, which was fun to watch in the beginning, and now it's kind of you know, as you say, it's unoriginal at this point. But you know, good marketing, good advertising says that repetition is kind of the key.
Yep.
And it may be that people are actually starting to listen to what's being said. I don't know. It's hard to know. The polling doesn't suggest that Bernie's pulling ahead by any significant amount of, you know, not in leaps and bounds. The fundraising is solid, yes. So it may be what you said before, that his fundraising machine is, you know, extraordinary. And I think given what he learned in 2016, it probably is.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's put forth some pretty bold proposals this time around that are very, very expensive. And there have been a couple of times where I remember, you know, somebody putting one of the ideas he had put out had a dollar figure that was in the tens of trillions of dollars. And I thought, well, that's probably it for Bernie. You know, that when you actually come forward with a number like that and say that's what it's going to take, you know, everyone shrugs and says, well, it's crazy. And that didn't happen. If anything, it built certain momentum. He certainly got more detractors who were much louder about the idea is crazy and it's, you know, he's a socialist and this is not the direction we want the country to go. But there were a fair number of people who jumped on board, too.
Do you think there's any effect in the media of a tendency to want to downplay Sanders and his message because you don't want to be painted as a quote-unquote liberal media member?
Well, I mean, we face that. That's something we face all the time in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about it a lot with folks that, you know, we often are criticized for what people perceive to be a bias. And Vermont tends to be a liberal state. The leaders in this state are talking about things that are kind of in the wheelhouse of progressives and liberals, and those things get moved upon in the legislature and in policy, and those are the things we write about. That doesn't mean that the media is being biased toward those particular topics. Those are just the topics that are being talked about. So in that sense, yes, when the media darling becomes, you know, Warren and Sanders, and those stories appear on the front pages and are being discussed by the pundits, it all of a sudden feels like, well, here we go. Everybody's pulling to the left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have time to, you know, there's no scheming going on and those kinds of things in the small newsrooms in America right now. We're just trying to get the papers out. We know what the top stories are. Could I have put impeachment on the front page today? Yesterday, it was a 50-50 toss-up between putting a wire story about the impeachment, which was kind of a slow news day yesterday as far as that discussion was concerned, or that our senator running for president raised $25.3 million. Either way, I'm going to take hits today for, you know, yeah. I'd put either one of those stories on the front page.
What do you sense from your readership, just folks you talk to around the community, how they're thinking about impeachment? Is this something that they think is going to happen? Do they want to have it happen? Is there any unity out there, or is our community as divided as the rest of the country?
I think it's pretty divided across the country. I personally have not consulted with our editorial board on a position on it, because I don't know what the right direction is. I understand the calls for impeachment, but mm-hmm. I don't think that's a road we necessarily want to go down as a country right now.
Let me push back on that a little bit, just to play devil's advocate. Why not? What's the downside?
Well, I don't think that it will have the outcome that people think it has. I think most Americans still don't understand the process and what actually has to happen for impeachment. And you know, while it may, you know, he may get the votes in one place, he's not going to get the votes in the Senate, and it doesn't really happen. I think most people are saying that if you want to make a statement about getting rid of this president, make sure you vote in November, you know, and or, you know, that's where you can take your stand.
Yeah, and actually, as a matter of strategy, if you are a Democrat, which it seems like from the polls, most Vermont certainly leans in that direction, you may not want to impeach Trump, because the person waiting in the wings is Mike Pence, who is a more purebred conservative than Trump is, actually, and is more kind of tied in with the whole conservative political network in the country and so on. I read a very interesting piece in Politico about this actually last night, where they were saying that he would probably emerge in a very strong position going into 2020, because he would look like the voice of calm and reason and et cetera, et cetera. And the Democrats have all been campaigning with, you know, with Donald Trump as their bogeyman, and now all of a sudden they're sort of reason, you know, their key argument is gone if Trump's impeached. So it's a little bit obvious on the one hand as you think it through, but on the other hand, it was interesting to see it all spelled out in this Politico piece that I thought was really pretty interesting. So I don't know exactly where the Democrats want to take this. Part of me thinks that if in fact there was this really real offense against the Constitution committed and so on, then the House almost has to do its duty, you know, just kind of as a pure, here's the sheriff and let's clean up the town kind of thing. But to the extent it's a political machination, then it may end up coming back to bite him. And maybe that was part of Nancy Pelosi's reluctance too, in her calculus. So I don't know. She's pretty cagey and doesn't lay all of her cards on the table, that's for sure.
Well, and I think that your take on this is right. The New York Times had a similar analysis of Pence, and you know, basically pointed out that for kind of all of the kind of all over the place that we see sometimes from the president, that Pence is a polished politician, strategist, and really does have the inroads that could, you know, and that may be why so many Republicans are not speaking out against the president right now, because they know that Pence really will give them the power that they want and need to keep the Republican legacy going.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to watch how this unfolds. I hear from some liberals and lefties, you know, Pence is dirty on Ukraine or blah, you know, this kind of thing too. Let's get them both, and then Pelosi's president. I say, yeah, keep dreaming, you know. I mean, the country was, I can guarantee you this, that in the time between now and the 2020 election, the country's not going to go through this twice. Let's just put it that way. So at least it doesn't seem like it. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think it will. You know, this nothing in this process moves quickly.
Yep. All right. Well, hey, Steve Pappas, you're always a great guest on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM. Thank you for joining me this morning.
My pleasure.
Let's do this again soon. We are going to be heading into a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News very shortly. Just before we get there, I wanted to mention our podcast, The Dave Graham Show, can be heard any time of day or night on the internet. And by the way, don't forget we live stream too, folks, wdevradio.com. If you are not near a radio on a given morning, but you have your computer or phone nearby, you can always go to that website, wdevradio.com, and live stream the show here. You can live stream WDEV pretty much any time. So if you want to listen to the Red Sox games or the high school basketball upcoming this winter, you are going to be in easily able to do that. But the other thing you can do is you can actually go to the website, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, and you'll come up with a list of our recent programs by guest and by topic. You'll be able to find out that Steve Pappas was my guest on this Wednesday morning, and go back and listen to his wit and wisdom. And so it's a good service, and we really appreciate the Warren Store for sponsoring it. They are the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, and they are a great place to go, especially this time of year. It's absolutely beautiful down in the Mad River Valley right now. Maybe not today because it's a little drizzly, but a lot of days this fall. Great place to go. Hey, there you go, folks. Down to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour. And stay tuned. We're going to be talking financial planning with Commissioner Mike Pichak of the Department of Financial Regulation. Back shortly.
Fall. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back on this Wednesday morning, October the 2nd, 2019, and I'm pleased to say that my next guest is Mike Pichak. He is the commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation in the state of Vermont. It used to be called BSCA, I think. Business? What was it?
So BSCA, yeah, BSCA was Banking, Insurance, Securities, okay, and Healthcare Administration.
Banking, Insurance, Securities, and Healthcare Administration. What a mouthful. So they call it BSCA, which always sounded like some kind of a nice warm soup to me.
I don't know. Exactly right.
I don't know what the all of the ingredients were, but the Department of Financial Regulation, much more streamlined name anyway. I gather you're still up to some of the same stuff, but one of the things you're doing is hosting a conference, I believe it's next week, up in the Burlington area on financial planning, and I've been seeing some advanced publicity about this and so on, and it looks like it's open to anybody.
Yeah, exactly right. So we're excited about this event. It's an investor forum, but really any questions that individuals might have relating to investments, financial planning, financial literacy will be topics of discussion, and then there'll also be an opportunity to ask questions. And like you mentioned, it's next Thursday, October 10th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m., and it's at the Delta Hotels in South Burlington. That's the hotel right on Williston Road there. And it's a free event, open to anyone. There'll be a free dinner served as well, starting at 5:30. The program will start roughly around 6 o'clock, and there'll be financial experts from our department, from FINRA, which is an organization that regulates the stockbroker community and has a mission of investor protection and market integrity. So really a good opportunity to hear from experts from an unbiased perspective about what people should be thinking about when it comes to personal finances.
And you're going to be pretty much, I described you earlier as the MC. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'll be there helping ask questions, helping ask Vermont-specific questions. FINRA regulates the securities marketplace, particularly, like I said, the stockbroker marketplace. So questions relating to insurance or banking are questions that our department will be handling rather than FINRA. But so really, it's a full realm of questions and opportunities for people to come and ask about financial planning. Again, investments, stock market, loans, insurance, all the questions that people might have when it comes to their personal finances.
Occasionally online, I see an ad that says something like, if you have a $500,000 portfolio, click here and learn all about what to do. I've never done that, maybe because that speaks to some of my own financial situation, or just we're not going all the way there right now, folks. But the I guess the question is, what do you find there when you open a site like that? Or I mean, it's the same can of worms, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, when you think about who might be behind a site like that, it really gets back to sort of the realm of financial professionals that are out there to assist individuals.
I think that one happens to be that I see all the time. I think it's Fisher Investments.
Yeah, so, exactly right. Yeah, so there's a mixture of ways to get financial advice. There's a totally online robo brokers, they're called. So basically, these are websites where you can enter your personal information. They'll use an algorithm to give you portfolio investment advice and continue to manage that portfolio over time. That's a very cost-effective way to do it. There's also sort of a hybrid model, probably like this Fisher Investment, where part of it's online, but they also have the opportunity for you to call in and get advice from an individual when you need it. And then, of course, the traditional in-person financial planning, and we have many of those individuals across the state that our department regulates, that will be providing people investment advice and the like.
So that's like if you see a storefront that says AG Edwards or whatever.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, we often get questions on this front because it's somewhat complicated to navigate exactly, you know, what is this person's title? What are their responsibilities to me? How are they getting paid? And those are all really important questions for individuals to ask when they're entering into a relationship. You know, there's basically individuals who are stock brokers or individuals who are financial advisors. And then some individuals will refer to themselves as financial planners. That's generally, I think, the three areas that we see. Sometimes to complicate this, they all call themselves financial advisors. So, you know, that's what that adds to the complication. But each one of those individuals has a little bit different take as to what type of services they can provide you and what obligations they have to you. So an investment advisor has a fiduciary obligation. They have to act in your best interest at all times. So that is an individual that a lot of people feel most comfortable with. But investment advisors have different ways that they get paid as well. They could get paid on an hourly rate. They could get paid on an assets under management rate. So those are important questions to ask when you're having these initial conversations with financial professionals to determine, you know, if it's a good fit for you.
Yeah, and when you talk about online robo-brokers, I think you referred to them as, how do you know that's not, you know, some boiler room in Moldova or something?
Yeah, it's a great question. Whether it's an online broker, whether it's an in-person, we always encourage people to check out a website called BrokerCheck. This is a site that has all registered investment professionals on it. It has firms and individuals. So that's BrokerCheck.com. If you type in that robo-advisor, robo-broker into that site, it will tell you if they're registered. It'll tell you if they've had any market issues, like if us, our department, if FINRA, if the SEC have brought actions against them, if investors have brought actions against them. So it'll give you a disciplinary record. But then another option, because we have more information generally at our department than is available on this website, is to call our department. Our number is 802-828-3420 to check on a financial professional. So we always advise individual investors to check, whether, again, it's online or whether it's a person you're sitting face-to-face with, because you never know, you know, exactly who might be registered or who might not be registered. And that's one of the biggest red flags for investment fraud.
Now, a lot of folks these days, if you spend a certain amount of time with any employer, you're going to build up, and they encourage you to build up, and some employers match your savings toward what's often called a 401k. I think there are some other similar instruments out there.
Yes, exactly right.
And I guess, you know, and I did this with the AP. I worked for the AP for more than 30, the Associated Press for more than 30 years. And every paycheck, they took a little bit out and they put it in this fund and they added their own match. And it has grown over time. I have it with an outfit called Vanguard. Which they tell me is, you know, the company says the AP's always said this is a good outfit with low fees and all that sort of stuff. And now I'm, you know, you left the AP in 17. What should I be thinking about with this? I mean, I've already rolled it over from a 401k, which I guess I was sort of told I had to do, into an IRA, And now it's kind of sitting there, and I'm getting by without having to dip into it right now.
Yep.
What should I be thinking about doing anything with it, or just sort of monitoring it now and then, looking on the website?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of points there. One, just to touch on the retirement piece and employers that offer a 401k match. I mean, that is really free money, and any financial professional, any financial advisor will recommend that you take advantage of that, that you try to put as much money away into your 401k, not just because it's a good investment vehicle that's tax-deferred or sometimes tax-exempt, depending on if it's a Roth IRA, but it also allows you to get that free money from your employer. So that's a great way to build your retirement nest egg, if you will. When you're thinking about, when you've changed employers, when you're thinking about maybe whether you need to dip into your fund or what you should you be doing with your fund, really you should be thinking about, what is your immediate investment horizon? Are you thinking about retiring in 5 years? Are you thinking about retiring in 10, 15 years? So then you should be thinking about how are those assets invested in your 401k, in your IRA, and to make sure that they have the appropriate risk appetite. So, for example, if you're thinking about retiring in the next couple of years, you're not going to want those investments in very risky stock equity investments. You're going to want them in more conservative and more liquid investments so that you can pull from them in the near future. So even though you're investing into these 401ks or IRAs, you still want to be looking at what type of investments are you holding within that product.
Yeah, and is there? I think as you age,
yep.
You might want to change what from more stocks to more bonds.
Yeah,
over time,
exactly right. Somebody that's in their 20s, I mean, the average split might be something like 80-20. You know, that 80% equities
is bond is stocks
yeah.
rather.
Yeah, 80% stocks and then 20% bonds or other kind of debt instruments. But then as you age, that sort of percentage changes over time. So when you're approaching retirement, it really should be flipped. You'll have maybe 20% in stocks and 80% in bonds. So you really want to keep thought about that. You also want to look at some of the funds that are out there that are targeted funds. Mm-hmm. So they'll let you know, if you're thinking about retiring in 2040, they'll automatically recalibrate that for you as you age so that you don't have to redo that every few years. So targeted funds are often a good thing for individuals that, want to have a light touch on their investment portfolio.
Now, you've done these conferences before, these kinds of financial conferences, emceed them or attended them and that sort. What's the most common question that you get?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think annuities are always a question that we get, complex products.
Should I get into an annuity?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Should I get into annuity? My friend told me, my financial advisor told me about it. I'm not sure what it is. And I don't blame people because the product, sometimes can be, 100 pages long in terms of the explanation of what it is, how they invest your money, what type of money you're going to get back at what terms. So, at the end of the day, an annuity, a basic annuity is a pretty straightforward product. You give a sum of money to a company and then they pay you a stream of revenue. Now it gets much more complicated from there because they're different type of annuities and they're different type of payment streams and different timing of the payment streams. But really, an annuity is a legitimate financial product. It's a product that certain individuals certainly should consider, particularly those that want to have some stable, secure, determined income during their retirement. But there's a lack of liquidity with those products. So you don't want to put, for example, all of your investable assets into a product like that. So it's always a balance, and they're products that are good for some investors and maybe not appropriate for other investors. So that's really why, if you're thinking about an annuity, it's really important to get a person that you trust to give you the investment advice. It's important to call our department to check on the financial professional before you invest, or check broker checkout to do your due diligence.
And I was wondering if the in the case of annuities, when you're looking at one of these things, well, actually, let me go to the really broad question here.
Yeah.
Because you talked about this, some of these products being 100 pages long and so on, and frankly, there's a lot of gobbledygook and disclaimers and all sorts of legalese, and it's just not a lot of fun to wade through this stuff for the average person. And a lot of people, I'll say me. Dave is somebody who I wasn't a stellar student at math in high school, I want to be okay in my old age, but frankly, I find a lot of this stuff some cross between intimidating and boring.
Right.
And
a good combination.
And so I sort of give me an attitude adjustment. What? How should I be thinking about this stuff overall and sort of, I don't know, my own fiduciary duty to myself and my family?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's important. I mean, we talked about how this month is National Financial Planning Month, and it's a good opportunity for you to take a minute, think about what your goals are for retirement, what your goals are for your family, what your goals might be for education, for buying a house, and to really sit down and think about, you know, how are you going to achieve those financial goals? I think that will help motivate people. You know, when they see themselves, they envision themselves in retirement, they try to envision the type of retirement that they want to live. Do you want to work in retirement? Do you want to be totally retired? Those are important factors. So really give a good thought about that. And hopefully that will help motivate people to start saving, start investing. But then to your point, I mean, I don't think you need to have an overly complex investment strategy to have a very perfectly comfortable retirement. Really keep it simple. There's some basic things that everybody should be thinking about. Having an emergency fund, for example, having funds set aside. So if your car breaks down, if you have some unexpected emergency, it doesn't derail you. Making sure you don't have high interest debt, paying that off as soon as possible. And then when it does come time to investing, you know, investing in low cost indexed mutual funds is a very good way of getting broad diversification and getting the broad benefit of the indexes in the stock market without having to put a lot of thought into it. So there really are some very basic things you can do to put yourself on the right path forward.
Yeah, and I think I've always thought to myself about this stuff that I don't mind saving. I mean, I tend to be a fairly cautious type personality anyway, and I don't go out, and my wife's the same way. We don't go out and blow big bucks on fancy trips or fancy cars or anything. We live fairly modestly and try to salt a little weight. You never know whether it's enough or whether it's too much and we're denying ourselves a current slightly better lifestyle or what. I mean, and those kinds of things are and then my Vanguard advisor calls me up and says, you know, do you want to be 58% in stocks or 60% in stocks? And I'm like, I don't know. You tell me. They're paying you the big bucks.
But, you know, some of those marginal decisions are really, you know, as long as you're in a percentage that is generally appropriate for your age, I think that's a good thing to get down into the minutiae. You can trust a financial advisor. You could make that determination about do you want to be a little bit more risk adverse or a little bit more aggressive. You know, but as long as in the big picture you're in that sort of appropriate split, which it sounds like they're providing you that right advice. So, you know, again, I wouldn't get worried about being too far in the minutiae when it comes to your investment portfolio. Certainly you want to understand the products you're investing in. But my point is you don't always have to invest in complicated products, particularly, you know, if you're someone that doesn't have a vast, retirement nest egg. People that have complex products are usually individuals or people for whom complex products are appropriate for generally tend to be wealthier and have larger retirement nest eggs with more complicated financial things going on. So if you're a pretty bread and butter, you know, sort of investor, pretty bread and butter saver for retirement, again, keep it simple. Make sure you're saving. Make sure you're investing, getting the benefit of that growth over time. That's really key and important. You mentioned that you're risk adverse, an issue that we see with younger investors, with millennials who grew up during the financial crisis, is that they're very risk adverse. So when you put your money into a bank account and just leave it there, you know, that money actually is losing value over time, particularly in the current interest rate environment. You're not even keeping up with the inflation that's going on year over year. So it's really important for young people to invest their money wisely and to invest it in, like I said, for an example, an indexed mutual fund so that they can get that benefit of the equity markets, which traditionally has gone up around 6.5% over time. You know, in a given year, it might be down even pretty big. But if you have 30 years to retirement, you have time on your side and you should be investing those savings into the equity markets in some way.
Well, it's very interesting stuff. And one more time on the actually, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Jim and Barry. Jim, what's up? Jim, are you with us?
Hi. I got a general question. I think it may have a complicated answer. I sat in on with
Jim, I think we're losing you.
Always happens. I get to the same spot here on 100. Can you hear me now?
I'll
make it real quick. She's got a life insurance product that she's being told it's going to have a retirement payment plus still have life insurance at the end. I'm just wondering how many products are like that with annuities built into life insurance, or whether that's possible, or how complicated does it get?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Jim. Like I said, a lot of these products are very complicated, particularly we've talked about annuities and how there's complicated products on that end. But there's also a lot of complicated products on the life insurance side as well, whether it's a term policy, which is basically a very straightforward policy for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. If you pass away during that time period, the benefit's paid. If you don't, the benefit's not paid, and there's nothing at the end of that payment stream. To other more complex, like universal life policies that have sort of a cash surrender value, they might have the ability for you to have some kind of retirement investment. That might be the way that it's pitched at the end of a certain period of time. So these are products that, you know, although complex, are somewhat common among investors and among individuals that work with a financial professional. So, you know, that's not something that to me causes a concern when I hear it, but like with any complicated product, you know, I really think if you're thinking about getting into it, you really need to understand it, not just have someone explain it to you, because people can make things sound good sometimes, even if they might not be the best thing for you. And again, that's why it's always helpful to work with someone that has a fiduciary obligation, like an investment advisor, so that you can get some of the best quality advice possible.
Someone told me recently, and one of the problems I find with this field is that you get a lot of advice from the just friends and acquaintances and so on. And somebody said if you have, I don't remember exactly what the cutoff was. It might have been $250,000. Your nest egg is insured up to. I didn't think that was the case, but is insured up to $250,000, and beyond that, you're kind of on your own or something like that. And that therefore, if you have a fund with, say, $300,000 in it, you should break it in half or something.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I think what they're referring to, and this would be the same if you had an investment or money in the bank, the FDIC is a federal insurance program for deposits created after the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. They will insure your deposits at a single bank up to $250,000. There's something called the SIPC. I think I might have the acronym right or wrong. I'm not sure. But it's the same thing on the security side. So if the securities firm for some reason goes down, if some reason your investment is lost, not because of fraud. They don't come in if it's a fraudulent situation, but if the company fails, they'll come in and provide you up to $250,000 on the investment side as well.
And these companies occasionally, I mean, like, was it Lehman Brothers? And
Bear
Stearns were in those situations?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly right. So people, okay. You know, obviously, if you have quite a bit of money and it's all at one location, mm-hmm. $250,000 might be a drop in the bucket. So it is something that you'll want to think about. Do you want to split your funds across multiple institutions potentially? But many of those institutions also provide you the opportunity to sweep your money out to multiple institutions overnight so that you do diversify your risk. But people can be assured that as it comes to the financial stability of the financial institution itself, that there are protections in place up to $250,000 for your investment and for your money that you have in a bank.
So, if you have all of, let's say you have $300,000 with Fidelity or somebody, it's one of the mutual funds, right? Should you be thinking about trying to split that money up? Would you advise that for people?
So, you know, most of the, these entities that you mentioned, the banks, they're all being regulated by either state or federal agencies. One of our top priorities is to make sure that they're in strong financial health, to make sure that they are not going to pose a risk to consumers. You can always go and look at a financial institution's sort of rating, if you will, from a credit agency. Mm-hmm. You would expect it to be a very high credit rating. And if that's the case, then you can have some comfort that it's a stable company. So I would really be thinking more. You know, it's not a bad thing to do, particularly if you're concerned about it and makes you feel better, makes you sleep better, then certainly you should do it. But I don't think it's a top priority for investors. I think they really should be looking at what is in their investment portfolio, making sure it matches their risk tolerance, make sure it matches their investment goals. That's a much better place for folks to spend their time.
Hmm. And how often, if you have money in a Vanguard or one of these investment houses, how often should you check in with your advisor there?
Yeah, so that's why we sort of are trying to promote both this event and Financial Planning Month, because we would recommend you check in at least once a year, mm-hmm. if not more frequently, because you know, things change throughout the year. You want to understand how your investments are doing. Your advisor wants to understand how your plans may have changed. Maybe you're thinking about retiring earlier or longer. Maybe you've had a new child in your family. Whatever it might be, from life situations to your financial goals, it's important to have that ongoing conversation and at least check in once a year.
And overall, do you think that the stock market is a good place to have your money right now? Is it? Do you think we're heading for any kind of a big crash or anything?
So, you know, it's an interesting question. I'm kind of an individual that thinks playing timing the stock market's a difficult game. But if you take a long view on the stock market, like with many investments, then your likelihood of getting a good return certainly increases dramatically. It's really difficult to watch your 401k, to watch your investments go down in the stock market and not want to pull out. But it's really the worst thing you can do, because you're probably pulling out when it's at the lowest, and you're probably going to go back in when it's at the highest. Really, you want to try to do it the other way. People, the best investors will actually run in when the market goes down, because they know eventually over time it's going to go back up. So I always think it's hard to game it. If you're thinking that a recession's around the corner, that maybe the stock market is weak, one advice that I might have is to sort of invest your money over time. So if you have some money to invest, maybe don't invest it all today, but maybe invest 20% of it today, 20% in 6 months, and so on and so forth, so that you get fully invested in the market, so that you can get that benefit.
All right. Well, Mike Pichak, the commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation here in the state of Vermont, has been my guest this last segment of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I really appreciate you coming by. Tell us one more time the time and place.
Yeah,
of this,
for sure. So it's an investor forum next Thursday, October 10th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. At the Delta Hotel on Williston Road in South Burlington. So really encourage people to come, answer all your questions, also providing a free dinner as well for attendees.
There's no such thing as a free lunch, but there might be a free dinner, folks. So check that out. That sounds pretty nice. Mike, thanks again. Hey, we're going to take a top of the hour break for some CBS News, and back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. And stay with us, folks. Interesting conversations coming up in the second hour of the program today. So we'll be back.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back, and on this Wednesday, October the second, 2019, and continuing into the second hour of the Dave Graham Show, we're going to be introducing a guest around 10:15 this morning from the theater production that's going on upcoming this month in White River Junction, and it sounds like a very interesting performance of a it's called Essay's Table, and we're speaking to the director, Jarvis Green. It is an all African American production. All the actors are people of color, and it is an off Broadway production, which I'm also told is a rarity, maybe a first time ever thing in Vermont. And so we're excited to hear all about that a little bit later this hour. We've got a few minutes to go in between now and then, and I just wanted to put the word out to all you listeners out there, and if you have anything on your mind that has been coming up in recent days, if you think I've been talking too much or not enough about the impeachment inquiry of our president, we can always add another layer to that conversation. 244-1777 is the local call-in number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255, and we welcome participation from listeners. It's kind of an odd thing, because sometimes people call and I'm not able to squeeze everybody into the time we've allotted for a certain topic or that sort of thing. So if you feel like you have been unduly cut off short in recent days or didn't get your call taken on the air here, you're more than welcome to call back in and try to pick up some ground here. And I don't know if Jack from Duxbury is in that category, but he's on the line, so we'll just check in. What's going on, Jack?
Jack, I just heard the phrase that I'm going to quote you. You said, this is an all-African-American production. And I just wanted to comment that it's kind of, why is that socially acceptable today and even sort of placed on a vaunted platform? Let's just reverse that. Let's just say, hypothetically, you said this is an all-white production. What kind of response do you think you'd get if you said this is an all-white production?
An all-white production. You know, I think it's an interesting question you raise. I'm not sure that it really is a... I don't know that this theater company bars applicants who are white. I think that it is a and I'm going to be asking Jarvis Green, our coming guest, about this. You know, why is it that it is an all black production, and also what is it about the location of such an effort? In White River Junction, Vermont is quite a predominantly white area, and so let's talk about that a little bit too. About trying to build a cultural crossroads here of some kind. I'm not sure, but are you thinking that there's possibly some discrimination going on here, or that this is? I mean, because you got.
I'm not saying that there's just sort of explicit discrimination going on per se.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just saying that, you know, in today's environment, everybody, there's this big hue and cry about having an honest and open debate about racism and so on. And I don't think we're ever going to get to that promised land when, again, it's just, you know, it's perfectly socially acceptable and everybody's supposed to kind of gush whenever something's like, you know, all African American. And yet, you know, let's just say, what if there was a theater company out there with sort of a stated purpose of being an all-white company? I mean, it would never happen today. It would never happen. And so, if we want to reach this, this lofty goal of so-called equality today, you know, I think we got to take a harder look in the mirror at all groups. And all races in America, at everybody's culpability, not just white America.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that there are different levels of culpability?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I do. Yeah. There's no denying the historical roots of racism in America. There's no denying the wickedness of some of the institutions that were in place during the founding of our country and onwards.
Particularly slavery and Jim Crow and so on.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely
not.
But I just think in today's sort of Black Lives Matter type society, I think that's the wrong turn.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that. Are you somebody who I hear people say from time to time, all lives matter, and they seem to take umbrage a little bit at the Black Lives Matter slogan. Are you in that camp?
A- Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the Black Lives Matter is slogan is patently racist. I think it's racism defined, because the Black Lives Matter, the intrinsic message there, it places one race up on a podium above others. It singles out one race, exclusive of all others.
Yeah. Well,
it's like a message of royalty.
Let me suggest a different way to think about it, and just put it in the mix and see if it comes out to anything that makes sense to you. And that is, you know, I've been in the news business for a long time in my, that's where I spent my career basically. And a lot of times one of the judgments you're making as a reporter or an editor is the thing you're going to report really news? If I go to my editor and I say, hey, I'm thinking about writing a story that the Sun is expected to come up tomorrow morning. He's going to say, or she's going to say, get out of here, you know, and so the idea that all lives matter, I think, would fall into the category of not really news. I think most people have established that as a fundamental understanding of our human existence. But the fact that Black Lives Matter in particular is news to some people. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, it's fair, but I still don't agree with it. If you're stating that that Black Lives Matter slogan is not racist, I'm sorry, I disagree. I think it is.
Yeah, to me, it's less a matter of racism than just trying to convey a message that not everybody has heard yet. And I mean, it's obvious that Black Lives Matter, because that's a subset of all lives, and all lives matter, and that's obvious, and so obvious that nobody ever needs to say it. And so. I mean, it's just a mathematical problem to me.
Sure, no, but it also ties into this greater question with the media. I mean, for instance, you know, just recently, the New York Times reported that, you know, their headline was a 12-year-old black girl in Virginia was assaulted by three white youth. Mm-hmm. And she reported that, you know, that they called her derogatory names, racist slanders, and cut her dreadlocks off. Well, guess what? The whole thing was a hoax. And so a few days later, the New York Times, when they sort of reported a little after story, their headline, they didn't mention race. They just said the 12-year-old girl has recanted her story. And, you know, why the first one did they go to such efforts to, you know, single out the girl's race? And then when it turned out to be a big hoax, they just, you know, all mention of race is evaporated.
Now, did you actually see that in the Times, Jack?
The New York Times recently.
Yeah, did you see that in the Times, or was it reported by some other media outlet?
No, I actually saw it in the Times. I actually looked it up.
Okay, I'm gonna do that too. I mean, I think some of those stories can get to be a little bit apocryphal. Hey, listen, I gotta go. I appreciate the call, and thanks for checking in with us. And don't be shy. I want to go to another caller here. Rama's on the line. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, hey, listen, yes, Black Lives Matter. Yeah, and it's facetious to say, but of course they matter, because all lives matter. Because if all lives matter, then we wouldn't have to state out in public Black Lives Matter. Let me suggest to everybody that thinks that's a racist trope, all you need to do is add the word too, T-O-O, at the end of that. And that's essentially what the Black Lives Matter movement has been trying to say the whole time. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter too, also, but Black Lives do matter. And by the way, if I have trouble at my home matters. I don't have to say my home matters too. If your car breaks down, your car matters. You don't have to say everybody's car matters. So that this whole bit about trying to pick apart a very simple common sense statement, which needs to be said and repeated publicly, because for years and years and years, hundreds, centuries in this country, black lives have not mattered. They have not mattered to the extent that white lives mattered. period. And that's why we don't say, well, white and black lives matter, because we accepted it. We accepted that white lives matter.
Yeah.
But you know what? We have not up until recently really dealt with the plain truth that black lives have not mattered to a great deal of this country. And to tell you the truth, when you look at Washington, D.C., the Trump-McConnell Republican Party, et cetera, I would say there's even more need to emphasize the fact.
Yeah, all right. Well, hey, thanks for the call, Rama. I appreciate it. Wanted to take one more caller and then introduce our next guest here, Fred from Newbury. I guess Fred from Newbury gave it up. Okay. Well, we'll go right to Jarvis Green then. Jarvis is the director of a new play. It's called, let me make sure I'm pronouncing this right, sir. Essay's Table?
Esai's Table, and I have one little correction. I'm not the director for the play. I am the producing artistic director of Jack Productions, which is producing this play.
I see. Okay, and Jack Productions is that based in the White River Junction area?
Yeah, it's based in White River Junction, right downtown at Brick's Opera House, which is a 240-seat thrust sort of intimate theater. And we sort of took over the space after Northern Stage moved out of the theater and built their own brand new theater right around the block. So
I see. So yeah. We're developing a theater district in White River Junction. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, that's what people are saying. That's what it feels like for sure.
That's awesome. Wow. And I hope you guys are able to work it out so you're not necessarily going head-to-head on competing nights, or how does that work?
No, I mean, I think that what we're noticing is that, like, we have this sort of thriving cultural, like, art scene happening in White River Junction. I remember in February of this year, we have our New Works Play Festival called Jag Fest, and Northern Stage was doing something. I think We the People, which is a new theater company that just popped up in White River Junction, was producing something, and then, like, all the restaurants were full. I mean, so it was just like, oh, we aren't actually competing. There's, like, enough people that, like, want to come out to the theater to see various things. So it's nice that we kind of all are doing different programming so that we're offering something for everybody, which is mm-hmm. nice. Yeah.
And that's nice, actually. I mean, a lot of times you can just start to develop a synergy, really, and folks recognize downtown White River Junction as a place to go for good live theater, and you end up. I mean, and that's why, you know, cities like New York and New York has Broadway, a bunch of theaters collected together. Boston, of course, has the theater district. A lot of cities are you'll see the theaters kind of gathering in the same few block area and that kind of thing. It's pretty amazing.
That's
phenomenon.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so this is a really interesting phenomenon in a lot of different ways. Tell us first off about the upcoming production that you're going to be putting on, the dates and times, and how people get tickets and that sort of thing.
Sure. So the upcoming play, it's called Esai's Table, which is a new play written by Nathan Youngerberg. The dates we open, we have two previews, October 10 and October 11, and our official opening night is October 12. And just to give you a little context about previews, because I know we don't get that a lot in Vermont, but previews mean that you'll come to the theater and you will see a performance of the show, like a full-on performance. Mm-hmm. But what that means is that they're still in rehearsal. So during the day, they are fixing and they're tweaking and they're maybe getting new pages from the playwright. And then in the evening, they, you know, put those changes in the show. For the audience, you don't really notice the difference from preview to opening. It's mostly for the creatives and the actors to just sort of get more time to, like, be with the audience and see what works and what doesn't work. So we'll have two previews before we open, and our performances are October 10th through the 27th. They're Thursday through Sunday performances. We'll have two shows on Saturday and one matinee on Sunday, a total of 17 performances. So it's only 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then we transfer it to New York. We have an off-Broadway run. We're producing it with a theater company based in New York called the Cherry Lane Theater. So it's a co-production, which means that we are, you know, splitting the cost and we're putting up the show together. And then it has a transfer into New York in March of 2020.
I wanted to ask about the off-Broadway designation, and I'm thinking you could probably guess already that I'm not a theater writer normally, and not an expert in this field by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just a talk radio host. In fact, it's just amazing sometimes the range of subjects we get on the show here. And I always have to say, I mean, the last half hour I had a guy on talking about financial planning. Don't ask me what to do with your portfolio either. So anyway, I guess I wanted to ask about the off-Broadway designation, because one of the people who actually, Steve Pappas, our good friend of the show, who's the editor of the Rutland Herald and Times Argus, was telling me about this, and he's actually the person who recommended that I get you on our air here.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, he's a great guy and a good friend of the show. He's actually occasionally fills in as the host here. So, Steve was talking about it either being the first or a very, very rare instance of an off-Broadway production in Vermont. And I just figured I'd ask you, what does that mean?
It means that we are, so it's the very first off-Broadway contract in New York. So what this means is that we are operating under an off-Broadway, with the off-Broadway league. So it only happens in New York, and off-Broadway contracts basically means that it is not on Broadway, but it is off-Broadway, which is basically you can only get in New York. It's sort of the downtown theater scene, which is like below 42nd Street. And 42nd Street is where all of the off-Broadway shows are, and anything sort of below 42nd Street is off-Broadway theater company.
And so
what that means is, because we're doing this co-production, the contracts for all of our designers and our actors and the producers are under this off-Broadway contract. So when it becomes award season, et cetera, we will, you know, either be nominated or not, you know, under the in the off-Broadway league.
So, oh, I see. Wow.
Yeah. So it unless you were in New York or producing with an off-Broadway theater company, you could never have like an off-Broadway show basically in Vermont.
I see. And I've heard about this, and again, pardon my ignorance here, but I sort of have a vague recollection of hearing about productions starting in places like New Haven or...
Yeah, of course.
And then going to New York. Is that the same process?
Yeah, it is the same process. It's sort of... So we're going to be using the same team. We're going to use the same actors, designers, set, et cetera. But it gives, I think back in the day, before shows went to Broadway, there was like this huge sort of tryout where, and sort of like the birth of regional theater and why regional theater exists. It was this place where directors, actors, creatives could really work out the kinks of a play and learn about the piece before it would go into the commercial realm. So it's definitely a process that sort of birthed the regional theater process. But like, I think because of financing and money, et cetera, those processes have become like very, very, very short. And I think now, like most regional theaters, you have like a 3.5 week, 2.5 week process before you are introduced to an audience. And so with this play now, we have 3.5 weeks here, 3 weeks of rehearsal, and then we'll go to New York, have another 3 weeks of rehearsal and 6 weeks of performances. So it gives, and because this is a new play that has never been developed before, I mean, there was a workshop production of it in New York at the Cherry Lane Theater. We developed it here as a new work, which basically meant that, like, they came, the playwright came here. We hired directors and actors to produce the play, but it was a staged reading. There was no costumes. They had their scripts. There was no lighting. It was the bare minimum.
Yeah.
To just sort of get feedback from the audience and, like, learn about the play. And so now we get a little bit of this really nice incubating and workshop. Well, not even workshop, because we're going to be premiering it, but we get more time to like work it before we transfer it to New York.
Wow, I mean, it sounds like a real artistic process, and of course it is. But I mean, it almost sounds like you're doing the final sanding in the coming weeks of a sculpture.
That's
or
right.
something.
Yes, for sure. So they've been in rehearsal. And just a little bit about the play. The play is about the playwright sort of wrote the play after Michael Brown was shot. And so he's really sort of interrogating, like, what...
Excuse me, Jarvis. You know what? I hate to do this, but we actually need to go to a bottom of the hour break. I did want to ask about the story that the play tells, but I suspect that's going to take more than the 30 seconds we have.
Okay.
So let's do that right after the break. And I've got some other questions for you, too. I hope you hang in with us and we can keep chatting on the other side of this break coming up. So stay with us, folks. We'll be back very shortly. My guest is Jarvis Green. He's with the JAG Theater Group. They're putting on a play upcoming in White River Junction. Esai's Table. We'll be back.
Fall. The crisp, clear days. A harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back. My guest is Jarvis Green. He is... head of JAG Productions, and the theater group is putting on a play in White River Junction beginning actually a week from tomorrow. Some preview shows first off on the, I believe it's October 10th and the 11th, and then the premiere on the 12th.
Yep.
And it all at the Briggs Opera House in White River Junction. And I was going to ask you a little bit about the play itself. What give us a description of the story it tells.
Sure. So the genesis of the play was the playwright sort of wrote the play after the Michael Brown shooting that took place in Ferguson, and what he wanted to interrogate with this play is just sort of to redefine like what it means to be human. I think that what he was frustrated with was how this little young 18-year-old boy who was like fatally shot by the police was sort of portrayed in the media. And he also wanted to interrogate like what happens when young black boys are taken away from us too soon. Like what happens to their spirits? Like who guides them into the afterlife, et cetera, et cetera. So this play is about three young boys and their joys and their hopes and their fears and their excitement. And it really just sort of illuminates their stories and their place in America, just in general. And so that's kind of, I don't want to give too much away because the playwright is sort of very clear that he wants to focus on that aspect of the play, which is the love and the joy and the hope and the courage of these young boys. And they're sort of taking on this mystical journey that's being led by Esai. And so that's sort of the shape of the play, and you'll just have to come and sort of see how that journey is sort of portrayed. And but what I love about the piece is that, you know, in my career, it's the first time that I've produced a play or been a part of a play that uses animation. So there's cartoon animation within the piece. We are working with the Dolly Lab, which is an animation program and graphic media program at Dartmouth College. And so we hired an illustrator that is Boston-based to do the animations. And then the Dolly Lab, it has been executing and bringing these cartoons and these animations to life. And then on top of that, the show has projection. So it's a very, what I love is that he uses this sort of mystical, magical approach to tell these stories of these young boys. And so I think for the first time, for me, again, it's the first time that I've ever been a part of a show that talked about really important issues that are happening in our country right now in a way that isn't just about the pain of it all and the agony of it all, but about magic and the hope and the joy of living and life in general. So I think it's going to be a really, really special moment for the American theater and for our community. I think that this is why this play is happening. It's like, it's one of the shows that we've brought to our New Works Play Festival that has had the most response. I got emails immediately after the stage reading of just being like, wow, that was powerful. I am so moved by it. I am shifted by it. Like, what can we do to make sure that this play gets a full-on life? And we're a small company. We're going into our fourth season. So to be able to take on a production like this that will then transfer to New York is a huge undertaking. And so the only way that that is possible is that, you know, when you have the buy-in and the support of your community. And this show is a true testament to community building and a reflection of how our community wants to live and be a part of a new world.
Really interesting. Now, you said this is you're in your fourth season now as a theater company, and I'm just wondering what kinds of shows have you put on previously?
Yeah, so I guess just a little context for your listeners. My theater company, we produce like classic, contemporary, and new theater. And our like the vision for what we do is to bring more compassion, empathy, and love into the world through the lens of the African American experience. And so how we do that is that we tell stories that challenge hierarchies of race, gender, class, and sexuality. So we opened our first season with a new play called Choir Boy, which is written by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who wrote the screenplay for Moonlight. He is the head of the playwriting program at Yale University, at Yale. Mm-hmm. And Choir Boy just actually had a run on Broadway, but it's about these a boarding school, an African-American boarding school, and it's a coming-of-age story for these young boys. And what's so fascinating about this play, which I've never seen in the American theater, is that, you know, again, it is about their joys and their hopes and sexuality and coming-of-age. And then we launched this festival called Jag Fest after we produced Choir Boy, which is our New Works Play Festival, where we invite 30 to 50 artists from all over the country. We pick out four directors and four playwrights, and they get to come here to develop new work that has never been seen before ever. And so it culminates into stage readings that happens at the end of the week. And then we launched in the spring of 2017, we did a production of Fences, which is a play by August Wilson. And August Wilson is a Pulitzer Prize winning African-American playwright who wrote this, what we call the American Century Cycle, which is basically he wrote a play for each decade in the 20th century about the lives of African-Americans. So Fences took place in 1954, and so he basically wrote a play for 1900, 1910, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And we're going to produce the entire American Century Cycle. So,
wow.
Yes, yes.
That's an undertaking.
That is an undertaking.
Yeah.
So we alternate between our world premieres and August Wilson. So, and that's kind of the framework and the template for our season. New Works Play Festival, world premieres of new plays, and August Wilson. And then we have these various events throughout the year. We just collaborated with this new building that just moved, that just came to White River Junction, called the Village of White River Junction, where they have this gorgeous rooftop. And we had over 200 people, ages from like 6 years old to like 60 years old, and we had various vendors, two DJs, and we had this gorgeous sort of end of summer rooftop party on this roof. And then last week we had what we call the Juke Joint, which is our annual kind of like, let's kick the season off, let's grab some friends and family and eat some delicious food and hear some performances, and that just sort of kicks off our season. It's a way to just sort of get us out of our silos and gather and be with each other.
What do you think of White River Junction as an arts center these days? I mean, they've got the cartoon school there. It seems like it's a burgeoning thing.
Yeah, it is. I think that it has so much potential. It's like fertile soil. There's fertile ground here, and I'm so moved by the work that like Matt Busey and all of the people that were here before I got here. Right. I think that that's why. So much is happening. So many businesses are opening, et cetera, because there's a thriving cultural arts scene. And that like, that's what keeps communities thriving is the arts. And people want to see their lives reflected. They want a place to come and to be and to gather and to see their neighbors. And so when the arts are thriving, and they are thriving in this community, the entire town thrives. So it's like, it definitely is like a creative economy. And it's really beautiful to see the evolution of White River Junction, which was once like, you know, people always say that like nobody ever wanted to come to White River Junction, like this is like a scary town, et cetera, et cetera. And it's now just like people walking downtown, and new buildings are coming up, and restaurants, and there's just like this energy that's happening here that's really, really electric.
I think we were getting to a fairly important and sensitive spot in this conversation, actually, where you were describing how we shouldn't regard the Upper Valley of Vermont and New Hampshire as sort of this predominantly white area, because what's the reason again? I'll let you articulate it.
I think it's a form of erasure. I think that. And I think it's actually sort of upholding a little bit of white supremacy. I think that to continue to use that narrative, right, that like silences the voices of people of color and Black people in general, and you have to constantly talk about your experience based off of like whiteness. And what I've noticed about being here and starting this company is that like, just the mere fact that it's here, people are making decisions to, you know, take jobs, to move here. And more importantly, the people that have been here that are of color and that are Black, et cetera, that are queer, that are you know, other, you know, they come out and they are so grateful for having this space where they can convene and be together. And quite frankly, it's really beautiful to see. Of course, I didn't, when I was living here, it was hard for me to find community and folks that look like me, and also going into spaces where stories were being told that reflected my own story. But, you know, taking the courage and taking the leap to start this company, right, what I instantly noticed is that there was like this outpouring of people coming out being like, oh my God, like, thank you. I've been, it's been really hard to connect. It's been really hard to find people that look like me. And just because the mere fact that you're here and that you're gathering and you have these events, like, this gives us an opportunity to come together. And so when we continue to say things like predominantly white and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like that just continues to sort of silence and make opportunities for Black people and people of color, like their opportunities to gather and to engage, like smaller. And so if we just take a moment to realize that like actually we are here and have been here, and yes, we can do statistics and no numbers, et cetera, et cetera. But I always just kind of take to heart that, like, once again, like, we have lived everywhere. And it doesn't, and when people say that it's predominantly white, I just think that's an opportunity to reflect on our own choices and decisions and how we're running our towns and our communities to keep it this way, because it actually takes work to keep it this way.
I also wanted to ask you, since we're on this theme now of race, I issued a little promo just after the top of the hour talking about our upcoming interview with you, and I think I described the play Esai's Table as an all African American production. And someone called into the show here actually and was rather critical of that, and was saying that we wouldn't be celebrating an all-white production, for instance. I'm interested in getting your thoughts. What would you say to somebody expressing that kind of a sentiment?
I'll like flip it around. Like, what would you say?
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know what you would say, because I think it's important that that like Black folk and POC folk don't have to sort of be the folk explaining to white fragility and whiteness about that very thing. So I'm really curious to know what you would say to that person.
I'm trying to recollect what I did say to him, and I think, and one thing I wish I had said was that, you know, most Shakespeare productions, since Shakespeare wrote the plays, have been all white productions. Just for one example of a wide range of the theater that have been put on in the history of theater. I think we got into this discussion then about the Black Lives Matter movement. He didn't like that as a slogan either, and I did have something ready there. I told him something I've said before, which is that it's not news to anybody that all lives matter. The headline that some people need to see is that Black Lives Matter, because that seems to be news to some people. And so, and that's why that's being made into a slogan, is specifically to put that headline into people's consciousness, I think.
Right.
And so in the same vein here, I sort of think that there is a difference about, and I got this gentleman to acknowledge that there's a huge difference in terms of where folks are coming from, just in the history of, you know, white people don't have the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and et cetera to deal with. And so if we're going to work out those issues in one form, you might see that happening is in an all black artistic group, just executing one type of expression like that. But I mean, so it's really it's not a matter of sort of mathematical equality here, where kind of each race gets a cookie. It's more a matter of dealing with what the issues are and then how the dealing process manifests itself, I guess.
Right.
Am I doing?
That's great. I mean, and celebrating that in a 2019, right, where people are saying like it's predominantly white, like, and knowing how diverse our country is and this world is, and we're having conversations about a town being like predominantly white, celebrating that actually there is an institution that is like, providing a different perspective. And so that we are actually a part of, how our country exists, instead of just sort of being like this kind of siloed, predominantly, people calling us predominantly white, et cetera, et cetera. And then like, you drive 2 hours south or whatever and seeing a more like robust, diverse community. I just think it's an opportunity for us to really celebrate Vermont, the fact that like it's that we have this now. We will see more diversity in our communities because of the mere fact that this organization and this company exists, and that it actually provides something for Black and people of color that actually live here, so that it isn't just, you know, a space where it's like primarily meant for white people, right? So that it is an equitable place to live. So I always tell people that, like, this, like, really, it's a time that we can celebrate this. Like, this isn't just my idea. This is like a reflection of how our town and our state and our world, like, is going and wants to go. This isn't a single, you know, this guy coming here to put on these shows, and then, like, it's an African-American cast. Like, not even, like, yes, we can say it's an African-American cast. Like, that's great. I'm also interested in a world where we don't have to say it's an African-American cast, where that person who is frustrated that we're celebrating an African-American cast would feel frustrated because we are seeing more shows and stories that, like, reflect the diversity of our world instead of just, you know, white culture and whiteness. I'm ready for that world where he's frustrated, where there's like a plethora of stories that are being told, and you singling out the fact that we're African American company would be like, well, why would you have to say that? Because there's an Asian American company down my street. There's a Korean company. There's a trans company. There's a formerly incarcerated company. There is this and there is that, that sort of like actually reflect our world instead of it not. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I guess, you know, one question that he might have, and it just popped into my head, and maybe it's a completely dumb question, I don't know, but all these diverse companies with different demographic labels, basically, what about a company that were to include people from all, I mean, and it is a dumb question, because a lot of companies do, so end of. I'll just drop it there.
Oh, like, yes.
You know, like, you could have an individual theater company, obviously, be very, very diverse. But that's a reflection of the growing diversity that you just described in our society, including here in Vermont. I mean, that is really something that people are growing in their awareness of that, and that's a good thing. Hey, Jarvis Green, I think, unfortunately, I got to tell you that we are at about the top of the hour here, which means the end of the Dave Graham Show for today. Really appreciate the conversation, and I wish you the best. Is it so break a leg, I'm supposed to say?
You can say break a leg. You can say break a leg for sure. And I really appreciate this time to be on the air. And again, everything that we do is about compassion, empathy, and love. So come see a show. Be a part of the Jack family, and I hope we can connect soon.
All righty. Thanks so much. Take care now. That's about it for the Dave Graham Show here today, folks. We'll be back tomorrow for another edition of our show. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio.